items reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now, here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll highlight AFGE's annual Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference with National President John Gage, Department of Defense Local 2516 President Paul Ferris, and Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights President and CEO Wade Henderson. But first, we've been joined by Senator Ben Cardin from Maryland. Senator, welcome to the program.
Well, it's great to be with you. It's really nice to be here and see so many people come to Washington to get their voices heard, which is important.
And of course, we're here today at AFGE's Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference. What's the main point that you would like to get across today?
Well, I really want the federal workers to know that what they do is critically important to our country. They're on the front lines of providing public service, and the services they provide and protecting our food supply and keeping us safe and dealing with innovation and technology and research and public safety. The list goes on and on and on. It's critically important to our nation. They do their jobs very well. We're asking them to do more with less resources. They've already been asked to sacrifice to help balance our budget. So our federal workforce has been on the front lines, and the way they're being demonized by groups in Washington is absolutely outrageous. So I want them to know I appreciate what they do every day. I'm going to be fighting to make sure that we do what's right and stop making the federal workers the scapegoats for our national problems.
Senator, what are the consequences of doing more with less or continuing to do more with less?
Well, ultimately, you see it in the services. My office gets phone calls from people who are trying to get their disability determinations at the Social Security Administration. Well, there's less people to do that work, so it's going to take a longer period of time. The Americans want to make sure that our borders are protected and are safe. Well, there's less federal workers doing that work. They want to make sure that we have the economy that can grow as far as jobs are concerned. Well, a lot of that basic research and a lot of the technology is done by federal workforce. With fewer there, it's going to take a lot longer to get these answers to help the job creation. So it's going to be services to people in this country who expect to get their Social Security checks or have their Medicare payments processed on time. There's going to be a consequence to that. But there also will be a consequence to this nation being as competitive as we need to be to provide the services that people expect. All that will suffer because we, quite frankly, just don't have enough people doing the work.
Senator, you mentioned some of the attacks against federal workers in Washington. As you're fighting back against those attacks on behalf of federal workers, do you think that people realize that this is about public service, that if you cut more jobs, if you cut more positions, ultimately the impact is going to be felt by the American people?
Well, there's this mentality in Washington that we don't need government. So I think to a large measure, the attack on the federal workforce is an attack on government. And it's interesting, the people who are making these attacks are ones who benefit from governmental services. It's their children who are getting the educational services. It's their parents that are getting the Medicare services for their needs. It's their families that want these services. So I think we have to continue to make this point. When you look at the type of sacrifices our federal workforce are currently making, the fact that they've already had a two-year pay freeze, I think more and more people in this country are going to say, wait a minute, let's do what's right, let's do what's fair. It wasn't our federal workforce that caused our fiscal problems. It was irresponsible policies in the previous administration that led us into two wars and cut taxes. That's the cause of our deficits, not the federal workforce.
And so ultimately, then, what's the best way to balance the country's budget once again?
We need a balanced approach to balance the budget. It's very important that we get our budget into better balance. I'm one of those who believe in the so-called grand bargain. Let's really get it done. And all of us need to be part of it. But quite frankly, you can't do it without revenues. Revenues are a historically low level. We've got to close those loopholes, and those who are the most well-off have to pay their fair share of taxes. So we need the revenues, but we also have to reduce spending. In the area where we think we really need to reduce spending are areas that have grown by the largest amount, such as health care costs. Well, we took a major step to do that in the last Congress with the health reform. Now we need to implement it to make sure that we get people out of emergency rooms who shouldn't be there, that we have the right protocols as far as preventive care is concerned, wellness programs. All that can help save the health care dollars, not just for the federal taxpayer, but for the American people.
Let's talk a little bit about health care reform a little more in detail. Of course, initially started rolling out at the beginning of 2011, 2014, even more comes in to play. What excites you the most about the Affordable Care Act?
I think the most important thing is delivery system reform. That means really doing things more efficiently, reducing the amount of hospital infection rates, which will really reduce costs. There are doctors at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore who estimate that that change alone could save as much as $300 billion over the next 10 years. And they're huge savings. Getting people to take care of themselves after they're discharged from hospitals so that we don't have readmissions to hospitals. Better use of technology so that we can avoid medical protocols. All of that will help save money. Taking on the insurance companies so they stop these abusive practices of saying because you're a woman and had a baby, that's a pre-existing condition. Those types of crazy things should have had no place in our healthcare system. I think all that means that we're going to have a much more rational system, a less costly system, but a more effective system.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Senator Ben Cardin. Senator, when you go around the state of Maryland and you talk to people about the Affordable Care Act point by point, do you find more buy-in whenever people are educated about some of these particulars that the law provides?
Oh, absolutely. I've been to all parts of Maryland, some of the most conservative areas, which you would think would have some problems with the legislation. But once I explained that we're making Medicare stronger, we extended the solvency for 10 years, we're now providing an annual wellness exam to our seniors, no co-pays on preventive care. When I explain to small business owners who currently pay maybe 20% more for the same coverage, will finally be able to get insurance at a comparable price as larger companies, they really start to listen and say, hey, that's not a bad idea. Or we start talking about how insurance companies can no longer use pre-existing conditions and they have to pay a certain amount of the premium dollar out in benefits. All that are very popular things to the people in Maryland and all parts of Maryland, and I think all parts of our nation. So I think they understand it and they get it and they want us to improve upon it. I think the frustrating part is I acknowledge that we can do better. We really want to build on what was done. Unfortunately, the current climate, particularly in the House of Representatives, where the Tea Party has this great influence, is that we can't take up health care. All they want to do is try to repeal what was done in the previous Congress. So we're wasting time in trying to get things better for the people in this country.
Senator, many in the press have suggested a very contentious climate in Washington, parties not being able to work together. Do you see that as a reality, or is it different when you work with your colleagues from across the aisle? Do you find more collaboration, or are those suggestions true that it is more
there's
contentious?
There's no question that there's a real divide in Washington. There's no question that the Tea Party influence on the Republican Party, particularly in the House, has had a major impact on us moving forward and solving problems. You know, I believe in the principles of the Democratic Party in which I was elected. I'm proud to be a Democrat in the United States Senate. But I believe when elections are over, you got to sit down and work together. You got to work across party line, get things done for the good of the country. So in the Senate, I've worked with Republicans on environmental issues. Senator Lamar Alexander, a Republican from Tennessee, and I have worked together on mountaintop removal. I've worked with Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine, to deal with some foreign policy issues. Olympia Snow, a Republican from Maine. I've worked on small business issues. So it's important that Democrats and Republicans work together to get things done. And I think we're getting some of that, but not enough. And there's no question that the major problems of this country need to be dealt with. The private sector needs predictability. The American people need predictability. And we've got to deal with our budget deficit. We have to invest in our future. We've got to get our tax code so that people understand the incentives that are there, not just on a temporary basis, so they know how to plan. These are things that should be gotten done.
In today's environment, when you're working really hard to repair the economy and put the American people in a good position, many times the conversation comes to cutting programs. Talk a little bit about the danger of cutting programs such as Social Security, such as Medicare, Medicaid. What do they really mean to people?
Well, they're lifelines. It's how seniors can live with dignity. I mean, before we had Social Security and Medicare, our seniors most lived in poverty. A large number lived in poverty. We've reduced that. So this is about dignity. It's about the values of America. What do we believe in? Do we want to make sure that everyone gets quality health care that's affordable? Well, that's what Medicare does. Do we want to make sure that there's a safety net so that people in their, as they live longer, have an income source? That's what Social Security does. Social Security is the only lifetime, inflation-proof, guaranteed annuitant that you can count on. You can't outlive your Social Security. Thank goodness. You know, many people plan on, you know, when they're 65 and they retire, they say, well, I'm going to live 20 more years. They plan on their income. They're 85. They're still healthy. And their business that they sold, all that money is gone. They didn't have Social Security. They literally would be living on the streets. So these are programs that speak to American values. And quite frankly, we're going to fight to maintain those programs. We're not going to let anyone mess up those important programs that speak to American values and the dignity of our seniors.
And ultimately, I would imagine as a representative of the people that you would be happy to raise the standard of living for all Americans through a program like a Social Security to make sure that they do have their dignity and are able to maintain some independence.
Well, absolutely. You know, when we talk about investing in America's future, we want to invest in our children, make sure they have the best schools, the best education, the best training. We want to invest in our infrastructure, that is our roads, our bridges, our water systems, our energy systems, so that we can compete with any country in the world, so that we have the great jobs here in America. We think we can not only create jobs in the high-tech and the internet-type jobs, but we can traditional manufacturing do well. So we want all those jobs here in America. We think we can make it in America. Well, you can make it as an individual. You can make it as a manufacturer. And that's where America's future needs to be. We want our economy to grow for all, but we're not going to do it sacrificing our seniors or sacrificing our young people. We want to make sure that we invest in the right programs for America's future.
As you look forward into 2012 now, what are some of your top priorities?
Clearly, number one priority is job creation. I want to make sure that we rebuild America to be competitive. That means I want a transportation program that makes sense, and energy programs. We need to be energy independent. We can get there. We can get there. So let's invest in an energy policy that makes sense, that will create jobs here in America, that will allow us to be secure from the intimidation of other countries who we depend upon for their energy. Let's get off that dependency, and let's be a better international country as far as our environment is concerned. All that can be done by investing in those types of programs. So you know, my top priority is for America to invest, to continue its strength, to get its budget into better balance, and quite frankly, to respect all, including our federal workforce.
Senator Ben Cardin from Maryland, we appreciate your time and your work on behalf of federal employees.
My pleasure. Great to be with you. Thanks.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, AFGE National President John Gage will join us from the union's Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. Joined now by AFGE National President John Gage. President Gage, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Jason.
Here we are today, the 2012 AFGE Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference. What are your top priorities this week?
Well, our top priorities this week is, first of all, beating back this attempt in the conference for the payroll tax holiday. That's President Obama's initiative. And there's a conference going on in the House and the Senate. And the GOP, the Republicans, have put up federal retirement as well as a pay freeze, additional pay freezes, to attempt to pay for it. And it has us hopping mad.
What do you plan to do in retaliation to those initiatives?
Well, first of all, we have 1,000 people in town, and we're going to be hitting the hill, and we're going to go to Republican lawmakers, or we're going to say, explain it to us. Tell me how cutting an LPN in a VA hospital caring for veterans, cutting, they make $40,000 a year. Tell me how cutting their salary puts an American back to work.
And there's a great ad that AFGE is running on that very issue right now.
We're up on ads on TV, and we're going to be doing them all week. And they're going to hear from AFGE this week. And we have to get, I think, in some of these people's faces, because last summer when they did the big deficit deal, they cut discretionary spending by $950 billion. Now, to come back with every bill that is up and say they're going to take another 30, another 60, federal employees gave $60 billion already out of their paycheck. And now to come and whack the retirement system by 40% is unconscionable. And we're just going to fight like hell so that it's not done.
If these initiatives are successful, what's the incentive for someone to want to become a federal employee?
Well, I don't know. You know, I think anybody or people will take jobs now. But, I mean, it really will change the civil service, which has always been about excellence and the government being a good employer, not the bottom of the barrel employer. And federal pay, no matter what anybody says, is less than the private sector. And the retirement was one of the big incentives for people to join the federal government. And now I think it just puts a real bad taste in the mouth of people trying to come into the government or people in the government. I mean, my point is, I'm getting the hell out of here. These guys are crazy. They're going to cut, you know, maybe I'll be grandfathered in if I retire. But, you know, staying around, it's just every bill that goes up, they attach a federal pay freeze and an attack on our retirement. And, well, it's not right, it's not fair, and it's more ideological than good policy. But that seems to be the way that Washington is these days, and I think it's coming down to either roll over to them or beat them.
Let's take a closer look at this situation. When you have fewer applicants and people maybe retiring earlier, saying like you did, you know, we're going to get out, what does that do to public service then, the service that the public relies on, if that excellence starts to go away?
The federal government, many of our agencies have been withstanding cuts for maybe 12 to 15 years. They're very half of inflation increases, very, very small increases. And the federal sector has been doing more with less. I don't think that service has fallen. In fact, I'm very proud of the service that, for instance, our veterans give, Social Security, you name it. But some of our less glamorous agencies, the Bureau of Prisons, for instance, our correctional officers are in peril with the staffing cuts and the mindset of even the management at the Bureau of Prisons. I mean, our officers are virtually the only ones in these prisons that are not armed. And people don't even know that correctional officers have no arms, no firearms, no protective devices. And these prisons are tough places these days. This is not the old federal prisons. These are all ganged up. And those agencies are the ones that really, I have great sympathy is not the right word. We have to correct these situations. And when they do across-the-board cuts, a place like correctional officers where they'll tell us that, well, we put 200 more officers into the system. And meanwhile, they open 6 new prisons and 15,000 new prisoners. So we're just falling farther behind, and it's a really tough scene in our prisons with assault among prisoners and assaults on officers is way up.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with National President John Gage. President Gage, I think you hit the nail on the head there. This is simple mathematics. You've got, in the Bureau of Prisons, inmate population way up, staffing levels way down. Combined with what you said, a more aggressive inmate population, the recipe there leads to nothing but disaster. When you talk to BOP correctional officers around the country, what are they telling you?
They're upset. I think they're upset with the Obama administration. You know, we had a letter from the Obama administration. We try to correct these things. We're not getting a whole lot out of Attorney General Holder, who is over the Bureau of Prisons. And it just doesn't make any sense how we can't get simple things like protective vests or non-lethal weapons like pepper spray, and that we can't have adequate staffing in these prisons. These are tough places, dangerous places. And I think the days when you walked around and you stood over 200 inmates in a housing division by yourself without a weapon, and you tried to maintain control through the force of your personality and just more psychological techniques, those days are over. And we have to protect our correctional officers.
The end result there speaks for itself. Of course, in 2008, correctional officer Jose Rivera, he was killed by two inmates with homemade weapons, and he was working by himself.
Well, we're seeing all kind of assaults up, and Officer Rivera was brutally killed, stabbed 26 times or so. But just yesterday, we had a suicide of one of our officers on the job, riding the perimeter. And I see these suicides up in our law enforcement, and a lot of that has to do with the incredible stress of the job. But it's not that the Bureau of Prisons is our only problem with these cuts. I mean, the House Republicans are just out to dismantle the EPA, HUD, Department of Education, Department of Energy, and it just gives free license to big business to either exploit the environment or unregulated at all. And those agencies are suffering huge cuts, and cuts that are large enough to really prevent them from performing their missions.
You just spoke to the attendees here at the legislative conference in the plenary session. What was the mood? What was the vibe that you were getting from the attendees?
Ripping mad, unfair, and we are not going to be a punching bag, and we're not going to be like a volleyball bounced over the net every time that a bill comes up. Like we're an ATM machine. Boing, take it out of federal retirement. Take it out of federal pay. Take it out of federal retirement. Our health insurance will be next, but they won't do that because that's their health insurance too. So our people are really, really concerned. And it's not that much of a personal losses that they feel. It's just that they know what it'll do to morale and to their missions and to their agencies, and they see it as a harbinger of even worse cuts and dismantlement of government should President Obama ever be not elected. Or some of these Republican guys are truly wild. I mean, Ron Paul doesn't even believe in government. And I think people are just motivated that we can't let the country go in that direction.
You yourself, a former federal employee at the Social Security Administration, how do these attacks against the people that you now represent as a national president at AFGE, how does that make you feel personally to hear these attacks against federal workers?
Well, it's such a bigoted attack. You know, well, everybody knows that federal employees don't work. And that is really so far from the truth. I wish they could walk a line, a tour in the Bureau of Prisons, be in a VA and watch these nurses hustle, scamper from room to room taking care of vets. I guess it's easy to have a whipping boy, and federal employees never really hit back. Kind of try to be above it all, the reasonable people, and don't mind what a few people say. But when a few people keep repeating it and repeating it until a large number of people now believe it, it's time that we set the record straight. And we are going to put a lot of money out into talking about federal employees, what they do, how they do it, and they should be appreciated by the American public, not denigrated.
And coming at a very important time now, 2012 is an important election year. What do you see coming in the months ahead?
I think it's going to be Return of the Jedi. I think 2010 might have been Empire Strikes Back, but I think 2012, we're going to see a highly energized, mobilized political action effort to keep this country on a reasonable track and not giving up to the extremists.
AFGE National President John Gage, we appreciate your time and your work on behalf of AFGE members.
All right, thank you, Jason.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll come back to the AFGE Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference with Department of Defense Local 2516 President Paul Ferris.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined now by Paul Ferris, the local president of AFGE's DOD 2516 out of El Paso, Texas. Paul, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Another year, another legislative conference, another time to sit down and talk to you about what's happening in El Paso. Tell us what you've got going on there.
We have a lot of exciting things happening in El Paso. We are going to be opening up start construction on a new hospital, and hopefully expand and take care of more of the troops that are coming into El Paso. The medical community, militarily, civilian-wise, is growing, and that's good to hear in all these budget cuts. We need to have more because we have a lot more to do with our soldiers that are coming back injured physically and mentally.
Tell us a little bit about the new hospital. How many beds will it have?
Well, I haven't gotten the full details on that particular hospital. It's supposed to be state-of-the-art. We're making sure that it is going to be able to handle the influx much larger than what we currently have at Beaumont, the current hospital.
How important is it to have a new facility, a new state-of-the-art facility for some of these veterans coming home from battle?
Well, much more than just a facility. We have to have the staffing, and in the reports that we've seen, we talk about a nice building, a larger building, but we haven't seen where the staffing is, and right now, it's important to note that we have a lot of folks that need help, and our medical staff, our providers, they're getting taxed to the very end, and they need as many new faces to help them. And so we need to start recruiting and getting staff on in the interest of America. I know right now the common phrase is, you know, too much government, lower the government, but these are true Americans that are veterans that have raised their hand to try to make a difference in our country, and so we do need more staffing in order to handle the large number of veterans coming back who are wounded.
Detail this for the audience, if you can, the need to have proper staff, the correct amount of staff in a facility to care for all the patients, and outside of that, also maintain the facility and just keep it running.
Oh, it's a tremendous amount of people. You can't shortchange. Understand that if you're not taking care of these soldiers appropriately, that means they're going to be outside doing something they probably shouldn't be doing because they're not getting the help and the support. And you can't just leave it on the VA system to do it. DOD, we handle the families. I like to say if we're not taking care of them all, then, you know, I'm selfish. If they don't get their families taken care of, if they're not taken care of, they don't reenlist. And if they don't reenlist, we don't have a strong military. And if we don't have a strong military, we don't have a strong country. So it's important for our mental health workers not to be overtaxed. They can only handle so many patients. coming back with PTSD. Call it what you want. We have folks coming back that need help. And those providers then also need help. They need relief. If you want to take care of our patients who are with wounds, physical wounds, you have to have the staff to change the dressings, to clean the dressings, the surgeons, the nurses, the food people, the ones that work in the mess hall, if we don't have the right nutrition. So everybody is important to making sure that that one soldier is taken care of, because if they're not taken care of, they may be on the street, and it's a sad thing. We can't lose any soldiers as we've done in the past because of budget cuts. This is our country, and shame on us if we don't take care of our country.
How have those that you've mentioned, the surgeons, the doctors, the nurses, all the people who maintain the facility, how have they responded to your efforts to make sure that there is a proper level of staffing?
Publicly, we're okay, Paul. We're okay. Privately, thank you very much. I'm glad you're getting them. Understand in the military system, they're not going to admit that they can't do it. Privately, we know better. We know the safety efforts. When somebody's been up for 36 hours, that's not safe. You have to say stop. But in the military community, they're not going to do that. So privately, they will accept, and they need help. They know they need help, and we're there to do it on a back doorway.
Paul, do you think the public understands that it's a patient safety issue? It's a worker safety issue when someone's working 36 hours at a time?
I don't know. When you're downfield, downrange, 36 hours, there's a reason you're awake for 36 hours. But when you're in a hospital, William Beaumont Army Medical Center, El Paso, Texas, United States of America, there is no reason to be working those many hours. Upon occasion, there may be some kind of trauma that comes in, but on a routine basis, it's poor planning, poor execution. When we talk about staffing, there was a big worry about this furlough that we were going to have last April. If you notice, it was all the military that got their pay cut. They're out in war and combat, and then for the civilians. Management would never make a final decision on who's important, who's not. But we talk about patient care, but it's the patient caregiver who's the one that's on the chopping block. It should be the supervisors who are getting cut during the furloughs because, as we know, they're doing paper care, paperwork. They're doing meetings. They've been telling us they don't do patient care. They're doing all these other things. Well, if that's true, then we need to have them out the door, and we need to have more staff on boots on the ground, so to speak, because patient care safety, our staff will be held accountable if they don't speak up. And then if they do speak up, then they're challenged to say, no, that's not true, it's safe. Well, it's up to the individual to determine that. Now, we don't put out an unsafe product, not at all. But at the same time, if the union wasn't there challenging the numbers, they certainly would go with the lowest bid.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Paul Ferris, president of AFGE's DOD Local 2516 in El Paso, Texas. Paul, how have budget cuts to DOD impacted you in Texas?
We're fortunate enough in the medical facility that we are hiring. It could be a mixture because of the amount of troops that came back, that are coming back, and the medical and psychological needs that are there. So we have not been hit as much as others, but nobody's off the table. We still have to perform our expectations as a union and what we tell our staff. You must do the maximum job possible. Don't give them a reason to get rid of you. We are fortunate. We're not better than anybody out there, but we have a special calling to take care of American heroes that makes America strong.
Today, of course, we sit here in Washington at the AFGE Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference. What are you hoping to accomplish this week as part of the conference?
Education. If we don't educate at the grassroots level, then we've failed. You have to understand why it is we need the staffing, the dollars and cents. If we have failed to make you knowledgeable of that, then we failed our mission. We have to make sure that you know our sincere request is for the good of this country, not for individual, not for a union, but for this country. And because we put our country first, the rest will come.
Paul, as you know, federal employees have been under attack for quite some time. How does it make you feel personally to hear those attacks from legislators, from some in the press?
It's challenging because they don't know. And this is why I say we have to educate. And I know those in the press, their idea is to stir up the trouble. If we've educated them, they're not going to do an interview with me. Everybody's going to have their opinion. That's why we have to do the best job that we can do and be happy in doing and knowing that we're doing it for our families, for our country. All federal employees raise their hand to defend this nation. There aren't other employees doing that around the United States, around the jobs. Federal workers do that. That means no one will ever be left alone or behind because we will come up and step up.
When you talk to people in your community, in your neighborhood, do they understand the value of public service?
They do. We have a wonderful community in El Paso. This is a city that is unlike other cities. If you've traveled around the United States, you're going to find El Paso is fantastic. The weather, the people, you can be welcome in any part of the city, day or night. It's the food, the entertainment. They understand and respect each other. They know the value of a dollar. They know the value of a family member. They know the value of the federal workers because everybody is touched to another federal worker, whether it's with the Border Patrol or whether it's police. And yes, we do have federal police officers. Whether it's somebody at the hospital, we're all intertwined.
What are you hoping to accomplish in 2012?
That's a tough one. I think I accomplish waking up in the morning. I take every moment and try to live it to the best, enjoy each moment, get rid of the bad ones. Then I have nothing but good ones and a full good day. I hope to make a difference. I guess if that's to accomplish having someone be educated enough to help somebody up, whether they're Republican or Democrat, that we help each other and we love each other. And when you're doing that and you're putting others before yourself, the rest all comes down. So just accomplishing, waking up in the morning and hopefully having a smile.
Paul Ferris, president of AFGE's DOD Local 2516 in El Paso, Texas. Paul, we certainly appreciate your time today. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. President and CEO Wade Henderson will discuss voter protections.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Attention AFGE members. Are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more. Visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. Joined now by Wade Henderson, the president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Mr. Henderson, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jason. I appreciate it. Great to be here.
You just left the Civil Rights Luncheon here at AFGE's Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference. You were the keynote speaker. What were some of the key issues that you hit on today?
Well, I was honored to be here today with AFGE, and I should say that we are pleased and proud that AFGE is a member of the over 200 national organizations working with the Leadership Conference. I was here today as the keynote speaker for its Civil Rights Luncheon, and the focus of my remarks really highlighted the problem of voter suppression, which is a campaign underway by a group largely of right-wing activists, think tanks, the Koch brothers, who may be known to you because of their activism on behalf of conservative issues. And we are witnessing the most sophisticated, well-coordinated campaign for voter disenfranchisement we have seen since the enactment of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. And I focus today on many of the practices and tactics of that campaign.
Talk for a minute about some of those practices and tactics that you mentioned.
Well, let me back up and say that, as you know, in 2008, we elected our 44th president, Barack Obama. But what made the Obama election so unusual and noteworthy, in addition to his being the first African-American president, was the fact that his campaign inspired millions of individuals who had never voted before to come into the political process. So in addition to African-Americans and Latinos, you had young people, you had older Americans, you had Americans with disabilities and women, you had working Americans, members of unions, inspired by the president's call for hope and change, who turned out in record numbers and literally helped rewrite the political landscape and the map of our country. And so the Obama election was a phenomenon. Now, some on the who opposed the president, who are right-wing activists, have decided that in the 2012 campaign, they're going to make sure that the president is not elected, and certainly not by the same volume and combination of voters that we saw in 2008. So there is a campaign underway, largely adopted in states with either Republican governors or Republican-controlled legislatures, to adopt laws that have changed the requirements for voting in those states. We're now seeing a number of states, for example, that require government-issued voter ID, where previously none was required. And that, it is argued, will help prevent voter fraud, even though in most of the states we're talking about, there's literally absolutely no evidence that voter fraud is a problem. In fact, the only place that we've heard of voter fraud recently was in Indiana, where the Indiana Secretary of State, a Republican by the name of Charlie White, was just convicted of 6 felony counts for voter fraud. Aside from that, there's been virtually none. In other states, they have chosen not to go with government-issued ID. They've instead cut down by almost 50% the number of early voting days, which had inspired a number of voters who had not engaged in voting before to come into the process. Or they've made it more difficult for third-party groups like the League of Women Voters, for example, to conduct voter registration campaigns. All of these changes on the surface appear small. Many of them appear to be unrelated to each other. But the truth is, this is all part of a very sophisticated, well-coordinated campaign that's really out of the laboratory of a group called the American Legislative Exchange Council. This is a right-wing think tank funded by those billionaire bully brothers, the Koch brothers, and it has been used to create a series of laws with a template. And that template has been adopted in state after state with the intention of making it harder for people to vote.
Now, what will you be doing in 2012 to ensure that all Americans have the opportunity to vote and participate in the political process?
That's a great question, Jason. Among other things, we're going to be highlighting and educating the American public about this problem. So your radio segment, for example, helps us do that, and that's wonderful. Secondly, we're actually going to be working with lots of small grassroots organizations in key states around the country to make sure they have the information and the resources that they need to help their constituents get the documents that they will need so that they're able to vote. And then we're going to be coordinating as well with a network of organizations like AFGE, for example, that have made a real commitment to investing in voter education and voter participation. And that commitment is being translated into thousands of new voters coming, making themselves eligible and being prepared to go to the polls. So all of that is underway, even as we speak.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking to Wade Henderson, the president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Wade, during your keynote speech earlier, you had made the connection between the attack on workers and the attack on voting rights. Talk a little bit about the connection between worker rights and human and civil rights.
Well, Jason, that's such a great question. First of all, workers' rights are civil rights. workers' rights are human rights. The right to organize is recognized in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was the handiwork of Eleanor Roosevelt during her tenure as First Lady. It is one of our proudest contributions to the world of human rights, and we're so pleased to be able to mention her name and to support her work. What we are seeing today is something that really is frightening, because we are seeing, as I mentioned, this very sophisticated campaign, and it seems to have four or five elements. Some of the investment is being directed toward making it harder for workers to organize. So we just saw, for example, in Indiana, a new law that was adopted that denies workers the right to organize in a meaningful way, or makes it harder for some groups of public workers to organize. We saw it in Ohio under Governor Kasich. We saw it in Wisconsin under Scott Brown, the governor there. We're also seeing universal attacks, as I said, on voter participation. So in all of the states that I've mentioned, in addition to many others, you're seeing elements of this voter suppression campaign. Thirdly, you're seeing a number of these states adopt new harsh immigration policies that are intended to undercut what the federal government is doing and really criminalizing what had been civil problems in state after state. You're seeing it in Arizona, but you're seeing it now, of course, in Alabama, in South Carolina, and Mississippi is soon to experience a similar effort. You're witnessing attacks on women. Largely in the name of Planned Parenthood, a number of conservative groups have attacked an organization that is not only venerable and worthy of support because of its years of service, but Planned Parenthood is worthy of support because it contributes to the betterment of health for poor women, regardless of color, in states all over the country. I'm proud that Planned Parenthood is a member of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, and we should know that the attack on Planned Parenthood has nothing to do with abortion, which is only about 3% of their work. It has everything to do with a woman's right to determine her own health care interests, and it has everything to do with a woman's right to vote at the polls. And then lastly, we are seeing efforts to privatize public service by going after jobs that had previously been union jobs, jobs filled by AFGE and by AFSCME members, and we're seeing those jobs suddenly privatized in ways that takes them off limits from public sector work. I mentioned to John Gage, the president of AFGE, whom I saw at the keynote address this afternoon, that he and I first met when he came to power, challenging the Attorney General John Ashcroft's policies of decertifying AFGE employees who worked at the Justice Department under the guise of protecting national security. Nothing could have been further from the truth, and John Gage and his AFGE leadership stood up to challenge those policies, and I'm proud that they're still challenging policies like that today.
How important is it for the labor movement to be a part of the election process, the political process?
The labor movement, first, is an inherent element of the civil and human rights movement. The labor movement was one of the founding elements of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights when we were first formed in 1950. And so the labor movement has an absolutely integral role to play in advancing civil and human rights. The movement to ensure that those who are eligible to vote can cast their ballots is, in my view, the primary function that we all have in an American democracy. You know, voting is the language of democracy. If you don't vote, you don't count. And I think that the labor movement today, with Rich Trumka at the helm of the AFL-CIO, with presidents like John Gage, who head AFGE, and other union presidents who are progressive, who get the sense that if they don't mobilize their constituents to go to the polls this election, they could well lose everything that they've worked so hard over the last 50 to 60 years to put in place. Nothing could be more important than engaging in the 2012 election.
Now, as you know, AFGE members will be taking to Capitol Hill to visit their congressmen and their senators. What's a message that you want to communicate to them as they go and spread their message to Capitol Hill?
Well, first, I'm very proud of AFGE members for using their power in the correct way, going to Capitol Hill, speaking truth to power, meeting with their members of the House of Representatives, meeting with their senators, and voicing voicing their commitment to American democracy as we know it. Secondly, I'm proud that AFGE members are there carrying a message that America needs jobs, America needs to be put back to work. That is the number one obligation of our elected representatives. They must assist the president in helping to put Americans back to work. Secondly, they've got to work on making sure that America's homeowners get a fair chance at survival. The foreclosure process, which has engulfed our country and which is literally making it hard for Americans to cling to the American dream, to buy a home, to provide for their families, is something that we must address. I'm proud that the administration, through Sean Donovan, who is a Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and other members of the President's economic team, have put forth a bold new program to help keep people in their homes. We must now convince the manager, the overseer, the trustee at the who oversees Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which holds, by the way, over 50% of troubled mortgages, to do more to help the country. His name is Edward DeMarco, and he needs to be highlighted for his obstruction of the president's program to help resolve the housing crisis. And we want them to speak, most importantly, also about making sure that election rules are changed to prevent the kind of shenanigans that we have seen in too many election cycles. You know, we saw it in 2010 in Maryland, where those who were supposed to be overseeing and guarding the election process were involved in actually corrupting it. We've seen it in other states as well. So we have to, as members of AFGE and as citizens of this country, stand up and tell our members of Congress that we will not take a back seat when it comes to protecting American democracy, and we will not allow them to do it either.
As you know, there are ongoing budget battles in Washington, and many times the conversation shifts to cutting federal jobs, cutting public services. What's the danger there of cutting public services to the American people?
Well, first of all, let me assure you that workers who deliver services to the American people have already felt the budget knife. Many of these offices that we're talking about struggling now to preserve have already suffered severe cuts over the last several years. The American people deserve a minimum floor of services that help define what it means to be an American who pays taxes. And AFGE and its membership do exactly that. So when budget sponsors, particularly on the other side of the aisle, sometimes say, look, we're going to cut budgets because that's really the way to eradicate the deficit, they do so, they make those arguments after years of profligate spending, where they showed little concern for the impact of their overblown budgets during the terms of President Bush. But now, of course, that America is most in need of economic stimuli that will help advance the goals of producing a better life, they turned a blind eye toward that. We're not accepting it. And we're not accepting this notion that somehow public sector employees, like those who are members of AFGE, should sort of tiptoe around and feel embarrassed because they provide essential services that the American people need. We're not accepting that. And we're glad that AFGE and its leadership are saying, look, we've had enough of that nonsense. We're standing up. We're going to be strong. And if you're not responsive to our needs, you will be responsive on Election Day.
Wade Henderson, the president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Wade, thank you for your time.
Jason, thanks for having me.
Thank you to our guests this week, Senator Ben Cardin, AFGE National President John Gage, Department of Defense Local 2516 President Paul Ferris, and Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights President and CEO Wade Henderson. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members.
The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible